Coming up next on Tech News Today, Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg's eye-opening manifesto. Sprint and T-Mobile might someday be sitting in a tree together. My friend Kayla Dahl isn't a very good friend after all. How researchers controlled cars with compromised Android apps. And friend David Spark is here. He shares his thoughts on this week's RSA security conference. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for Twit's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1708, recorded Friday, February 17th, 2017. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/TNT. And by Grasshopper, stay connected and run your business from your mobile phone with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, visit trygrasshopper.com/twit. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about some of the biggest tech news stories with people who are passionate about technology. I'm Jason Howell. Megan Maroney is out. Joining me in her place is the one and only David Spark. How's it going, sir?
I'm doing great, and thank you for inviting me. I'm absolutely so thrilled to be here.
Well, I mean, you've been on TNT.
I've been on TNT
a number of times in the past.
But not as a co-host.
And not in the new studio.
And not in the new studio. It's very exciting to be in the new studio. Yeah. So thank you for having me, and thank you, the viewing audience, for welcoming into you into your laptop.
Infused homes, or whatever
way you assume you're receiving this information.
We see a lot of people with a lot of different ways that they receive the information. In fact, we have a segment devoted to it a little bit later on in the show where people show us how they watch TNT. So you'll see one of those ways later. Wanted to congratulate you on 10 years in the business with Spark Media.
Spark Media Solutions is 10 years in business. A lot has happened in that time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so explain a little bit about your business. So it revolves really around social media and marketing.
And media production. I mean, I call myself a brand journalist. It also falls under the category of content marketing. For years, I kind of shied away from that term, but I kind of have to say it because it's what people understand.
Right.
But I'm a veteran tech journalist. I've been in the business for, over 20 years. I've been in more than 40 media outlets. And I just realized that there are all these companies that wanted the same services as a traditional journalist, but they weren't doing it themselves. Right. And so it was a big discovery when I was writing for eWeek magazine that people would pitch me all this stuff. I'm like, why don't you just write it yourself? And then just dawned on me, oh, they don't think to even do that. Now it seems quaint. I mean, this is over 10 years ago.
A lot has changed.
A lot has changed now. Now everyone's doing that. And so things have changed. Like the biggest change in our business was up through 2011, nobody had a content marketing person, let alone an entire content marketing team. Mm-hmm. 2012, that all changed. And now it's, there are events and every marketing department has something like that. So it's completely changed. The whole industry has changed. But
what was the signal that made 2012 the year?
Well, everyone finally understood the value of content marketing, the fact that we all can be a media company. I mean, all of us can.
Right.
I mean, that was just the big wake-up call for everyone. And so we had to, we shifted our business model to be less service-focused and more product-focused. Like, we have very sort of specific products. So, but we're mainly around the B2B tech market. I mean, we've just got so many relations and connections, and we've covered it, and that's where our knowledge is, and that's what we've kind of stayed in that space.
Yeah. Part of the reason why you were at the RSA security conference.
Our eighth year being there this
year.
Wow. Yeah, we've covered it. And I will just say one thing that kind of amazes me about the security industry is it is the one industry that so drastically changes on a year-to-year basis.
Oh, man, this year more than any.
It's bizarre how much it changes.
It really seems like this is a really big eye-opening year for the impact. Like a lot of people, you know, think security, oh, I don't need to worry about that. That has nothing to do with me. I feel like we're right in the swirling, you know, right in the pot with it right
just
now.
Just at the
it's
moment.
It's intensifying and heating up in a way it hasn't just, in a long time.
But it happens every year. Just at the moment you become complacent, something scares the crap out of you. And that's what I refer to the RSA conference as, the Scare the Crap Out of Me Festival, because every year I learn something. I'm like, no, are you serious? They do that now? Oh, great. Now, something else to worry about.
I was happy before I came to this conference.
But yeah, do you remember when security was a thing? Like, oh, if you're just smart, you won't get hit. Like, all you have to do is just be smart. Don't be stupid. Don't click on the... Those days are so long over.
Yeah.
Forget
it. It really does feel that way.
Yeah.
Well, we've got a lot of news to talk about, and then we're going to dive into kind of your week at RSA and kind of pick that apart a little bit, some of the themes, all that kind of stuff. But before we get there, let's talk about some news stories. First up, Facebook has a new mission revealed at length in a comprehensive, to say the least, 5,800-word letter published yesterday by CEO Mark Zuckerberg on the Facebook site. In it, Zuckerberg focuses on how Facebook can help facilitate a global community that is informed, supportive, engaged, and inclusive. He writes about helping to build social infrastructure to allow that kind of community to grow and to thrive. And he writes about battling a trend of misinformation and that risks of the polarization of opinions. And just, I mean, it covers so much ground in this manifesto.
I think
this qualifies as a manifesto, right?
It is a manifesto, but more importantly, like, has Zuckerberg ever written anything in this kind of tone before? Like, I mean, he's put out public things, but everyone sort of kind of hinted at it a little bit, but is he kind of running for office here in this?
He says he's not.
Announcement?
I mean, there's a lot in his actions of you know, he has his yearly goal that he does every year. And this year, of course, his goal is to meet somebody in every single state throughout the U.S. And that seemed very, you know, very politically, I don't know, in line with what, you know, people in politics would do. Mm-hmm. Get down on the ground with your constituents and shake hands and all that kind of stuff.
So
there's a lot of crossover right now between technology and politics, and this seems like one big piece of that.
Well, the crossover, we feel that Facebook was very much involved in the whole political process. And in fact, the bizarre amount of information, or the fear, misinformation we're getting is coming through Facebook.
Yeah. So Zuckerberg touches on a number of things here. I've kind of detailed a few of them. He seems to recognize that the amount of users that Facebook has, that's 1.86 billion at this point. It's insane.
It's bizarre.
That massive amount of people actually results in people becoming more extreme in their beliefs, kind of finding their, well, I guess it's the filter bubble, right? It's the whole idea of these filter bubbles, where with that many people subscribing to the service and interacting with it, it doesn't necessarily help or aid in the kind of learning of all sides. People tend to find the side that they associate with and group together. And is that a good thing? It's almost like Zuckerberg, at least in this writing, he's really kind of changed a lot in even 6 months. Whereas, you know, there was the point a while ago, I can't remember how many months ago it was, where he said the thought of Facebook having any sort of influence over politics or whatever is, quote, crazy.
He's
moved from there.
Yeah, but
a lot.
He changed that attitude rather quickly.
Thankfully.
Very, very, very.
So I don't know how, I mean, there's a lot to read through, a lot to kind of think about and kind of internalize the place that a social network like Facebook has in society, which is weird to say about a technology company or a service, that, you know, an app on your phone. Mm-hmm. Where does this fit in society? But Facebook's numbers are so high that's a consideration that you have to take at heart. And I think this is kind of him coming to terms with that.
I agree.
Sources to Reuters say that SoftBank, which is Sprint's parent company, might actually be interested in selling Sprint to T-Mobile's parent company, Deutsche Telekom. Back in 2013, you may remember, in a bit of a role reversal, Sprint pursued a buyout of T-Mobile, but was shot down due to opposition from U.S. antitrust regulators. But now, SoftBank is apparently disappointed with Sprint's lack of growth in the U.S. Sprint has been surpassed by T-Mobile to be kind of fourth in the list in the U.S. and would be willing to give up its control of Sprint for a minority stake in T-Mobile if a merger were to be approved. those negotiations would be expected to begin in April. Do you think it could work a second time around?
To get this merger to actually happen, or a different merger to happen? You know, I actually think that Sprint and T-Mobile are very different companies. Sprint was a client of mine that and I worked with them for quite a number of years. And again, I don't know the inside, but branding wise, T-Mobile seems like a more nimble company.
Yeah, I would agree.
Where I actually worked with Sprint, and nimble would not be a word I'd use to describe them.
Would you say that T-Mobile is more willing to take risks in the market?
Well, they do marketing risks all the time.
It's kind of part of their DNA.
Part of their DNA, and they're okay taking hits. You know what I mean? And I never got that sense from Sprint, for that matter. But, you know, they can make it work. Great too. But, yeah, I'd like to see more players enter the market, which is possible. And this is sort of the – who knows what's going to happen with our new president, who is very pro-deregulation.
Right.
In a very sort of vague sense. So is that going to hit the telecom industry?
Yeah. I mean, it'll be interesting because T-Mobile CEO John Legere said at CES, I believe it was, that a merger was a potential future outcome with the Trump administration and with the new FCC as that's kind of taking shape. However, Trump is also noted to be against the AT&T Time Warner merger. So it's not necessarily a sure bet. I don't know. Maybe this is just more of a gamble than anything, but you kind of get the feeling that maybe the powers at play would be a little bit more hospitable to this now versus 3 years ago.
I think they will probably be more hospitable, but as we have seen, we can predict little to nothing.
That is true. Remains to be seen. We won't have to wait very long, right? April's just right around the corner. German regulators are calling the My Friend Kayla doll an espionage device and as such have banned its sale in the country. On the outside, the My Friend Kayla doll looks like any ordinary children's doll, but one of its features is actually the ability to ping a server via Wi-Fi for answers to questions that children ask it using the onboard microphone. The doll reads the results of queries back through the speaker that's also embedded in the doll. Nuance, which is the company that makes the voice recognition software used by the doll, said that the voice data is not shared in any way. However, the terms of service seem to like put that to bed.
Yeah, you have to watch the video. You saw the video.
Yeah, the video is good.
The video is excellent. This video that they're showing right now, where he, at this point he's actually showing how physically far away you can be from the doll, essentially outside of the building, and you could be eavesdropping through your own cell phone. Listen to this. And more importantly, the end user license agreement, which nobody ever reads.
Yeah, and it's really long.
Which is endless. He does a sort of visual demonstration of that. Just as this is the part, we can use your child's voice in any of our marketing or advertising. Mm-hmm. It's pretty nasty.
Sounds pretty wrong. I would imagine that crosses some legal lines.
That came up as a privacy concern that people had. I was speaking to at RSA.
Oh, okay.
That's the demonstration.
Related
the size
to
of
this
the
doll specifically?
No. In general, talking about just sort of privacy concerns of lay off my kids.
Right.
There's a lot of lay off my kids.
That's definitely a line that you don't cross as far as that's concerned. There's also the article, the NPR article anyways that I read, says that you can ask it, can I tell you a secret? And it gives you the answer, something along the lines of, go ahead and tell me. It's just between us.
Just between you and us and this connected internet server that goes back, and it could technically be worldwide.
Yeah.
If you wanted to.
I mean, this really kind of points to the bigger issue that surrounds security in the IoT space right now. And just this lack of attention on devices like this around protecting it from intruders, from hackers, from anyone that can kind of recommand that hardware in a different way, thinking that, that's just not going to happen. I mean, in this day and age, if it has a Wi-Fi antenna on it and hackers be hackers, they're going to figure out a way in it. How much of a threat is that? Why not begin going out of the gate with security in mind? And that's what IoT is learning.
Yes. Well, the as we all know, the number of IoT devices that don't even have the most basic security in it is bizarre. But you know what this story reminded me of? The second I saw this was the old, and this goes back geez, I think this 16 years ago, the Furby.
I remember that. Yes.
Now, that wasn't an internet connected, but it recorded something in a room. So you could stick a Furby on a shelf.
And it would recognize it and alert and record.
And there was some story about like government agencies were banning Furbies.
Because they were afraid it could be some sort of... Meanwhile, was there any way for the Furby to like transfer any data off the device?
It couldn't transfer, but the idea is this innocuous little doll that's sitting on a shelf that could record things that were in a room.
That's still weird, creepy. Also, Hello Barbie, right? That was last year. There was a big kerfuffle. I don't know if it qualifies
as a kerfuffle. But the other thing you should realize is that, you know, this is this came out of Germany, the ban on this doll. Europe has far stricter privacy regulations than we do out here, specifically in Germany. Mm-hmm. So you know, a lot of people would actually kind of like the privacy regulations that are in Europe. But yeah, they're far stronger than what we have. In fact, far more stronger. Like they have them. I would go so far as they have them out there, where not so much out here.
Yeah, I mean, you can't necessarily buy this doll in Toys R Us or Walmart online, but you can through Amazon. It's not prohibited from being on Amazon for sale in the U.S. So I suppose if you want your doll keeping tabs on you, there you go. From connected dolls to connected cars, and a big thanks to Force Talks and the TNT subreddit for this story. Kaspersky security researchers actually conducted studies of 9 Android apps for connected cars. They found that it's possible to commandeer the cars connected to those apps by either rooting the phone or installing malicious code. In doing so, they demonstrated how hackers could, you know, do things like locate a vehicle, unlock the doors, and even in some cases, start the ignition. Yeah. I was going to say ignite the car, but that's something that's like worse. A Samsung problem. So how big of a threat do you think this is as we move even further into this world of connected cars?
So this is actually rather significant. And one guy who's kind of been on the forefront of this whole sort of securing automotive devices, a man by the name of Josh Corman, who is one of the founders of a group called I Am the Cavalry, which are where bits of my, I think, what's their line? Is bits and bytes hit atoms or something to that. So when the idea is when the digital world hits the physical world, right, kind of an idea. And the fact that they saw all these incredibly, all these physical devices that had internet connections to them, and not just cars, but things like pacemakers, things like that, and a lot of health devices as well had some kind of internet connection to them. The car industry was a little slow to come on, but this was something discovered before 2015, actually, before the Black Hat of 2015. There was in fact, it's at the bottom of this article. They show that video. There was a demonstration that they could actually control a car remotely on the highway.
Right.
And this, by the way, this was the number one story. This is it right here. This was the number one story of Black Hat in 2015. I mean, everyone's going crazy about this. But this is new in that it has to do with apps that can control a car, which the fact that they looked at like 7 different apps and they had all these problems with it. Mm-hmm. Just so the number one advice Josh offered, which I thought was good, is just start asking questions. When you go to buy a car and they tell you, and it's internet connected and you control it by your app, and they say, just start asking security questions like, what kind of protection is on this? Like, one of the things they said is that they didn't even encrypt the username and password
app. Such a
And
this is kind of, that kind of goes back to our point on the previous story that we talked about just like thinking about security when you're creating these products and not overlooking something as basic as that.
But the problem in the industry, and this is very much in the startup industry, is the speed to get product out there is so intense that security is often an afterthought. Luckily, you know, if you're familiar with what is known as the DevOps movement, the idea of getting the operations group and the development group together, they're the more secure DevOps movement that's happened. It goes, okay, yes, get the developers involved, get the operations, and get security involved, and actually iterate in fast turn with all sort of 3 departments working together. So even if you are creating a startup and you do want to go fast to market, you can actually go fast to the market securely.
Yeah, right. Yes, and that's pretty darn important, if I do say so myself. You know, Tesla cars can actually allow for a car to be driven by the app. So you can.
Yeah, I don't like that.
Illustrating just one possibility of. Now, mind you, there's the other side of this, which is that in all of these cases, it required the phone to be rooted in some cases. It required malware to be downloaded on the phone or installed. And those things, for that to just happen randomly, you know.
Well, it doesn't happen randomly, but it
doesn't happen randomly, but it does happen out of someone not understanding that you don't download an app from the wrong store or whatever the case may be. But let me ask
you, how many times have you just been messing with your phone and your hand slips and hits something and it just, oh, I didn't want to do that. Like, how often did that happens all the time?
I suppose, but how but when does that particular accident sync up with carrying a payload such as this?
It all depends on what's trying to get into your phone. I mean, we'll talk more about this when we hit the security discussion, but
we got a lot of these topics.
It's for that. Let's just say, I go back to the days of you just being smart are over.
Dang
anyone
it.
Anyone can be hit.
Dang it. I've always just relied on my smartness.
Your wit ain't going to cut it anymore, Jason.
All right. Well, fine. This one's a little bit easier to wrap my head around then. You turn on your favorite YouTube video, and before you can watch a single frame, you sit through 30 seconds of unskippable pre-roll advertising. I think for a lot of people, that's actually the point that they close the browser and they move on. That is about to change, apparently, according to Google, who will phase out the 30-second unskippable ads starting in 2018. So we still got another year of those. However, that doesn't mean unskippable ads are going away entirely. 15 and 20 second unskippable ads aren't going anywhere. They're sticking around. YouTube also plans to ramp up the use of its 6 second unskippable ads format as well. And some of the places that I was reading were kind of alluding to the fact that the 6 second unskippable would be replacing in many cases the ads that you can skip after 5 seconds or whatever. It would just be, well, we're just going to lock in for 6 seconds and move on. I mean, you're already there for five, so whatever.
For the person who has to complain about the 6 second ad,
yeah.
You're getting something for free. Stop complaining.
Right. That's very
six seconds out of your day, you can handle it.
Yeah, I guess the 30 second ads were originally designed to kind of satisfy TV advertising budgets, and what they're realizing is that advertising for TV, what works there, doesn't always necessarily translate to what works on the internet.
Let me take you back to really, really early days. So in I was a member of ZDTV and Tech TV back in the day. And the reason we had a hard time getting advertisers is because nobody was creating 30-second commercials at all that were in technology. Because this was, you know, way before YouTube or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And so, because it was really expensive to produce those. And now they're very, very cheap. And so in the early days of online video streaming, all they did was take the TV ad and put it online.
Just put it online.
There were no custom made online ad. It did not exist at all. So I think this is just a holdover from that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of what it seems like. Also could be, you know, this could be an indication of what's working in other places. Facebook obviously has a big effort in video right now. Some are saying that this is YouTube going, more competition from Facebook. We better change what we're doing to keep people on our platform versus other platforms.
There's no doubt about it that YouTube has the better video platform right now, but they don't have the better social platform, and they kind of missed the mark on that. And I must say, the discussion space on YouTube is not usually the best.
Mm-hmm.
But on stuff that very informational based, I do find it valuable. But I don't think YouTube all of a sudden got scared by Facebook. I think they're chronically getting scared by Facebook.
More and more with every passing month. All right, coming up, as we've been talking about a little bit here and there, David has been at the RSA Security Conference all week. So we're going to chat about the big takeaways, some of the overarching topics, and all that kind of stuff. But first, let's take a minute to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. They're the sponsor of this episode. If you want to secure that house, you found your dream home, you want to get in, but you know, sometimes the mortgage process isn't always the easiest situation in the world. You got to pull all that information from a million different places. It's not an easy process, let's say. Well, when it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, that's why it's important to work with someone that you can trust, has your best interest in mind, that can kind of help you through the process. With Rocket Mortgage, you're going to get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. So you're not going to waste time searching through all those stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial information to get that mortgage approval in minutes. You can even kind of play around with the numbers. You can adjust the rate or the length of your loan in real time. That'll help you make sure that you get the mortgage solution that's right for you right now. Whether you're looking to buy a home or refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. So skip the bank, skip the waiting, go completely online at quickenloans.com/TNT. That's quickenloans.com/TNT, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, and MLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support.
And I will throw in, I actually refinanced multiple times with Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage didn't exist at the time. And I'm not, they're not a sponsor of me, but I had an unbelievably positive experience with them. It was phenomenal each time. They were fantastic.
Excellent. We will keep that in there. All right. So, David, appreciate that. So, David, you were at the RSA Security Conference, as we've been talking about, all week in San Francisco. And you kind of mentioned this a little bit earlier, which I kind of assumed is the case when you go to a conference like this. But you had to walk away from something like this with doom and gloom or not necessarily look forward to going every year. I mean, there's a lot to learn, but there's also a lot to be afraid of.
Yeah. I think the thing that... I'll tell you two really quick stories. One was, you've probably heard of this malware that will infect a hard drive, but it'll actually infect the BIOS of the hard drive. You heard of that one?
No, I haven't. No.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so you could format the drive a bazillion times. It doesn't matter. It's not going to get rid of the virus.
Awesome.
So that's I talked comforting. To one guy, and this story is amazing. I talked to one guy because I was asking people, what's the worst malware story you ever heard? I was shooting some videos for Cylance. They're an anti-malware company. And I asked them, people are going, what's the worst malware you've seen? And this guy, I was like, oh man, you win. This is the worst. Mm-hmm. He bought a hard drive and, you know, installed or whatever. And all of a sudden it stopped working. And it didn't think on, you know, it was, you know, virus. I think, oh, it's just a busted hard drive. I'll send it back to the manufacturer.
Right.
Like, we wouldn't all normally do that. Well, it actually had a virus in it. It was on the BIOS. He sends it back to the manufacturer. It infects all the hard drives at the manufacturer.
Oh my goodness. No
I
way.
I was like, oh my. Now that's it's insane. The problem's exponential.
That's insane.
Oh, my God. That's insane. And then the other one.
Did they tell him this? Did they say, hey, that hard drive you sent us.
They finally figured it out. Yeah. But it's a BIOS level. Yeah. Wow. Oh, geez. It's such a pain. I was like, wow, that's a doozy.
Uh-huh.
That's a. So it's stories like that I would hear that would make me go, oh, geez. Like, I got more. But the thing that I heard definitely a considerable amount last year, but it was even bigger this year, is just the whole issue of scaling security. Just this problem is so mammoth. It is so intense, and it's just exploding at a level that nobody's brain can wrap around.
Mm-hmm.
And what are you going to do? You can't throw enough bodies or money at the problem. And so machine learning was a very, very big topic at this conference.
I was just going to say, like, yeah. It seems like the answer to everyone's prayers these days is artificial intelligence. If we don't have the capacity to keep up with it, why don't we just create some artificial intelligence and stick that on the problem?
Yeah, and that can work. And what it does is it stops, you know, the people from doing the mundane tasks.
Right, okay, yeah.
And that's the hope.
Frees them up for other more important
things. So here's the theory. The theory is, and, you know, theory and application are two different things. So the theory is, the idea is, we have all this machine learning and all this artificial intelligence that will, you know, analyze as much of this information that's coming in, all these attacks, using big data, analyze this as much as possible, and only just narrow it. So just at the point that we can't handle it anymore, I hand it off to a smart person like Jason, who can then, you know, analyze it and make sense out of it.
Don't hand it off to me. I'm the wrong
guy. He's the wrong guy.
I'm the wrong guy.
But that is the theory behind it all.
Yeah.
And a lot of the vendors on the floor were selling this solution. This was kind of the big solution that was being sold at the time. But as I was talking with Dwayne Malanson, who's of Tripwire, he goes, every year everyone thinks the technology vendor's going to solve it. It's all people and process. That if you got to work on your people and process first and foremost to get your problems solved. And there weren't a lot of vendors selling people in process.
Right, right.
No, there's, you know.
Because they're all working on the technology.
Exactly.
That's the easier thing to scale out to people.
I didn't see it so much this year, but I think it was last year I saw more of just sort of the companies, you know, as added service were offering, selling, you know, we'll train your people to not be so stupid about security kind of a thing. And I saw a lot more
of
that.
We need to train a lot.
Or I saw more last year than I did this
year.
Right.
One topic that you mentioned in prep is the idea that, contrary to popular belief, vendors aren't going to protect us from security intrusions effectively, let's say. Why do you say that?
Well, you can't assume that they're concerned. Like I was saying, it's people in process.
It's a convenient thing to do, though. Somebody's going to take care of you.
But the funny thing was, we was talking to some people, and it's amazing, believe it or not, that a lot of people will buy security products and not actually install them. And that same Joey Milan that I mentioned, he said what he heard this. He said, next time you're going to buy a security product and not install it, feel free to buy my product.
But seriously, probably install it if you're buying it.
So that'd be a good idea to install it.
I mean, for the general consumer, are you talking about just like antivirus software?
That gets to the topic of what is known. This woman, Wendy Nather, who used to be a 451 research and now of Duo Security, she coined this term called the security poverty line. And there's a huge number of individuals and companies that are way below it, way, way below it. And so this is the sad reality is the security poverty line keeps raising, like the bare minimum you need to stay, quote, secure. And again, I know that's a vague term to use, keeps rising. But for the individual, you're looking at, you know, your basic antivirus and also just backups, having good backups offsite, and onsite for that matter. Those are sort of basic things that you need.
And behavior
as well. But as we have said, behavior alone doesn't cut it. I wish I did. Again, that doesn't cut it anymore.
How exactly are companies failing to protect users? I mean, a lot of companies are focusing on ways, you know, giving tools that empower a user to protect themselves. Are they missing anything glaring? I mean,
well,
IoT is one way where maybe they are.
But. You know, here's the big thing is that most organizations operate in a sense of, well, you work in finance, I work in accounting, that person works in security, you know, that. And so we all have our respective jobs. Mm-hmm. The problem is, for security to work, it kind of has to be everybody's job. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like everybody
has to worry
about it. Even the
weakest link can open everybody else up to something.
So that's where we get into the whole people and process discussion. It's the need to make people clear that it's everybody's responsibility, everybody's job. That's where, you know, there was a lot of sort of selling of education. You know, hey, it'd be a good idea if you... if you all kind of trained and understood the importance of this, because it's everybody's job, everybody's responsibility.
Right.
The thing that scared me the most was ransomware. Have you guys talked about this a lot?
Well, yeah, we have. So it's been a big topic all year. We had, of course, a number of stories that were around kind of ransomware hitting hospitals, in some cases hitting police departments. We had a story a couple of weeks ago. It's suddenly, I'm failing to remember it, but you know, another indication of ransomware where they didn't give in and they were just like, you know what, screw it. We've got backups. We're not going to
That what I also learned is that doesn't. So here are the two things, big things I learned about ransomware. It is automated and you can buy kits. Do it yourself. All you need to get a kit and really low morals, and you could pretty much do. You set up a Bitcoin account and these kits. And it's truly automatic. You set it up and it just goes out and starts hammering people. And it's more just a point, try to hit. And for those of people who don't know ransomware, what it does is encrypts the data on your drive. And the idea is that from that, then you have to pay a ransom to get it unencrypted.
Hey, we've got all your data. If you want access to it, you drop this
Bitcoin
back. And we'll give
it. Right, you pay the Bitcoin amount. Again, so therefore it's, you know, completely untrackable. And it's automated that, you know, you set it up, it just keeps going. Because here's the thing. All the previous sort of hacking attempt or hacking processes, which was mostly credit card based, is extraordinarily expensive because it's very manual, the process to do it. Bitcoin isn't, or not Bitcoin, excuse me, ransomware is not utilizing Bitcoin for that matter. So it's actually a very lucrative method. And that's why I heard a little bit about ransomware last year. Of the people that I talked to about just bad malware stories, I would say like 40% of them were telling me ransomware stories. And like what you were just saying, I had stories of people who paid, people who didn't pay and decrypted it, were able to do it. And some people who just gave up and said, forget it.
Walk away from the data. What about people who paid, but they didn't get it unencrypted?
I heard one case of that.
But I'm sure that it happened.
But the other story that I didn't realize is sometimes, and this is not as prevalent, it's usually kind of I hit it and just do it. But sometimes the ransomware will sit dormant for a while, and it will infect like multiple versions of backups.
Oh,
so
wow.
Then when it pops, you can't even go to your backups.
Dang, man.
Yeah, I know. It's, again, the scare the crap out of me festival.
Yeah. So I'm assuming, so is that the threat beyond ransomware? Like, what's next? Is ransomware going forward?
I spoke with a gentleman named Scott Borg who's been doing sort of predictions and research about this for quite some time. And the next wave is far more lucrative, way, way more lucrative. And that's going after financial markets. So he claims that there's evidence of people shorting the airlines just before the 9/11 attacks. And so what could happen is there could be a planned attack on, you know, against some kind of an institution, mm-hmm. and organizations could short, meaning, you know, bet that it's going to do poorly, mm-hmm. A certain company or certain industry, whatever, and then make some kind of physical attack or digital attack, you know, any kind of attack against them. And so this is their, now here's the sad reality. This guy's predictions are pretty darn good. Mm-hmm. And so this could be and this would make, you know, huge fortunes to be able to do something like this.
I think what we need to do is walk over to the one big technology thing that powers everything and pull the plug. This is frightening me.
Is there one giant plug?
In my perfect world, there is. There's one device that powers all the devices. And you just go, you know what? Forget it. So obviously, we're entering a new year, new administration here in the U.S. We're preparing for many initiatives that are actually going to change in light of that, change things that, you know, that the internet has operated in certain ways and security and all that kind of privacy, all that stuff. I have to imagine that was a big topic at RSA.
So, yeah. So I was shooting also for the Electronic Frontier Foundation,
right.
Also at both at B-Sides and at RSA. So the nice thing at B-Sides, for those you don't know, it's kind of a more hacker community. Goes to B-Sides, and EFF is usually a sponsor, very involved in it as well. So the love among that community for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, for those you don't know, they fight for digital privacy rights. Huge, huge amount of love. I was surprised that only maybe 40% of the people on the RSA floor that I ran into knew of the EFF. But we talked a lot.
That's surprising.
We talked a lot about privacy, and I asked people what they thought the Trump administration was going to do to protect people's privacy and what they didn't want the NSA to know about them, things like that. Common things that came up, themes that came up was they don't want to know their financial records. They don't want to know their browser history because then they could sort of create a docket on them. Mm-hmm. They want them to stay off their kids. Lay off my kids. I don't want you to bug in my kids. And then feeling of what they felt the Trump administration, some people, you know, played it politically correct, like, you know, well, they have yet to announce. We don't really know what's going on. And others was like, well, he's a businessman and businesses make more money from the more information they collect from us. And he wants deregulation.
Right.
So my feeling is he's going to be pro-business and let them collect as much as they want. So it is. And others were like, well, you know, under the Obama administration, there was a lot of, you know, privacy implications there. So
for
they
sure.
say, you know, it's
a lot of
it's
changes.
It's going to, well, change it, but no, there, I mean, there, the NSA had some major
right.
Capabilities of what they could go after. A lot of people was like, you know what, it's going to be the same as we had the last couple of presidents, so nothing's going to change.
Right, right. What about the kind of the near term, 2017? Was there any talk about like what to expect over the course of this next year?
The big thing is, here was the interesting discussion. This is more on the journalism front point, is the way we're gathering information, because the fact right. that hacking is now, as you know, from the Russian hack or the supposed or the very well documented supposed Russian hack of the DNC, that hacking is not just financially based, and you know we've talked about this for quite some time. You know, it's also very much government sponsored efforts, mm-hmm. for that matter, that we have to look out for that, and also the fact that hacked information is now a new news source. So I spoke to Joe Mann, who's one of the investigative reporters on security for Reuters, and he said, "Look, we've got four different sources of information right now. We've got real news." we've got fake news, we've got hacked information, and we've got hyped news. Mm-hmm. And you, me, everyone watching, we have to make sense of all of this. Like, yeah, that ain't easy. And so this is where all the confusion starts. You know, and we've discussed this, I'm sure, plenty, but like, who, like, all this confusion just creates
confusion.
Like, no, but like, nobody can agree on facts anymore.
Right, right.
It's impossible to agree on a fact.
Well, and yeah, and it's really hard to hear something and know how you feel about it because there's always a lingering doubt, or that confusion is such an element. Man, life was so much simpler a few years ago.
Have the internet.
Yeah, it's true. Maybe what we need to do is get rid of all of our modern PCs, go back to the Commodore 64, and we'll connect to each other with bulletin board services. We'll become a sysop. That's what we'll do. Mm-hmm. Any final thoughts? Anything that we missed?
No. You know what? In fact, that was all the information that came out of RSA. There was no more. None.
No more. No
Nothing
more.
Else came out.
Because honestly, I don't know if I want to hear any more.
No. It's the thing is, I was there for the entire week.
Yeah.
And I absorbed as much as my brain could handle.
Yeah.
Like, it was. Yeah. I couldn't handle much more. Oh, yeah. That's what the floor looks like.
Nice.
Right there. That was a time-lapse video that my partner, Joy Powers, produced.
Excellent. Love it. Thank you for diving into RSA. Really appreciate it, because I know we've covered, I think, maybe a story or two that has arisen or been announced through RSA throughout the week. But it's really nice to get a sense of the actual event and kind of, I don't know, the tenor, the general kind of thought, the collective thinking from the floor, because it's such an important thing right now.
I would tell you, I come back next year, hopefully, to have the same conversation on the Friday at the end of RSA. And I will have a completely different stories, because every year it changes so drastically.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've got some feedback. Friend of the show, Sam Boelsamid, wrote into TNT at twit.tv regarding our story from the other day where the driver of a Tesla Model S effectively saved another driver who was having a health issue in another vehicle. So, you know, basically drove up to the front of the car and slowed down progressively until the car stopped and then got help. Sam says, that's just the tip of the iceberg of what's possible with connected vehicles. Back in 2007, GM launched the stolen vehicle slowdown and recovery system through its OnStar telematics service. If an owner reports their car stolen to OnStar, the call center can dial into the car and force it to slow down and come to a stop so that police can apprehend the thief and recover the vehicle. Now, as automakers are getting ready to roll out vehicle-to-vehicle communications, there are all sorts of interesting functions that are possible. At the 2014 ITS World Congress in Detroit, Honda demoed what they called virtual towing. And actually, Sam attached a link to a video that shows this. If a driver finds themselves in medical distress, they can press an SOS button that sends out an alert to other cars that are passing by. A good Samaritan can pull in front and engage virtual towing mode that uses the V2V to command the car with the distressed driver to follow automatically. The lead driver can then guide the other car to the hospital for assistance.
See, that all sounds really good. And then we go back to our discussion about hacked cars.
It always goes back to our discussion of hacked cars, doesn't it?
Well, but
don't shatter this dream.
I would just briefly mention that this always happens with new technology. When we talk about AI or anything, everyone immediately goes to, what's the worst thing that could happen?
Yeah, that's true.
It always happens.
Yeah. Hopefully,
I brought it up. So there you go.
Thank you, everyone, including you. I probably would have gone there too if you hadn't. Coming up, why someday in the near future you might choose to avoid all left-hand turns on the road. But first, let's take a minute to thank Grasshopper. They're the sponsor of this episode. Grasshopper is a virtual phone system designed for entrepreneurs. Grasshopper works just like a traditional phone system, but it requires no hardware purchase, because they have an iOS or an Android app that you can use on your phone. And with that app, callers can reach you wherever you happen to be on the phone you already have. Grasshopper allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. When you make a call, your client is going to see your Grasshopper caller ID instead of your personal phone number, even though you're calling from your phone. You simply select a toll-free or a local number. You record a custom greeting and add multiple extensions to your business. Toll-free numbers, of course, awesome for marketing, makes your business sound even more professional, so you can set that all up with Grasshopper. Set up department and employee extensions with custom call forwarding to any phone in the world. You can get voicemails emailed to you as audio attachments, if that makes it a little easier for you to preview those. You can also send and receive SMS text messages from your business number. Join the over 250,000 Grasshopper customers today. Plans start at just $12 per month, and you have a full 30-day money-back guarantee to try for yourself. Turn your smartphone into a business line with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit, and we thank Grasshopper for their support. TNT's fan of the day is David Blakey on Twitter, who sent us this picture saying he's brewing beer while watching TNT. We've had people making tea while watching TNT. Now we have people making beer, and I wish that I could drink it. It doesn't look so awesome now, but I'm sure it will eventually. Good stuff. I hope it turned out all right.
It looks better when it's actually in a bottle or in a
and
mug.
And cold.
Not in a,
it looks
a giant tureen.
Yes.
Like it's warm beer.
But I'm sure it's delicious. And I'll take
it. Also probably at that point smells horribly. I used to actually work behind the Ankerstein Brewery in San Francisco. And man, first of all, I don't know how anyone works in a brewery because it stinks like you wouldn't believe. It's a horrible stench.
We appreciate that they take one for the team.
I do appreciate it because I like it when it's finally bottled.
Exactly, exactly. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we'll find it. All right, finally, Cold Sprint on the TNT subreddit passed along this story explaining why UPS trucks don't turn left unless they absolutely have to. I've seen this before, but I thought this would be a good kind of topic to bring up for those who had never heard this before. In doing so, in only turning left, the company says it saves 10 million gallons of fuel per year and avoids the equivalent emissions of 200,000 plus cars. That comes out to about $300 to $400 million saved for the company every year. It's also safer than crossing all that cross-flow.
Yeah, traffic. I heard that something like over 20% of the accidents are from left turns and only like 1.2% from right turns. So that, they've been doing it for years, but the reason it's a new story now is because they've actually refined it and they've got more data over the many, many years that they've been doing this.
Well, and they have systems. So it's not just the drivers knowing, oh, I'm just only going to turn left.
Yeah.
They have their kind of mapping system. They don't rely on something like Google Maps because Google Maps doesn't allow you to kind of determine, like, don't take left turns unless you absolutely have to.
You can tell it not to take a highway, just
right.
Not left turn.
Right, exactly. So they have their own system that actually prioritizes the idea of not taking a left turn. They're allowed to if they need to. It's just that most of the time they don't. And it's just weird. Like, in my brain, it doesn't work out to think that by doing that, you end up saving gas because I feel like you go out of your way. But I guess that's not the case. They have the studies to prove it.
That's true, and but it really only works for UPS or a giant fleet because they said should we, you and I, stop making left turns? It said no, unless you're doing 25 stops, which we normally don't do.
Right.
I wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah, I mean maybe not from the fuel efficiency standpoint. Yeah, that's a really good point. Actually, I hadn't thought about that, the multiple stops. But from protecting people, you know, crossing those lanes of traffic, I guess there's a higher percentage of pedestrian accidents that happen as a result of people turning left.
Also, a UPS truck is probably much larger than your vehicle as well.
Yeah, you've never seen my vehicle, though. It's a big, bad beast. Not really. David Spark, awesome to have you up in the studio.
Thank you
really
so much for having me. It's great to be in the brand new studio. I love it. It's awesome.
Right on.
And I apologize to the viewers who are not getting to see Megan right now. But I hope I'm reasonably attractive enough.
Well, super stoked to have you up here today. Tell people where they should follow what you're doing, what you want people
to know. Spark Media Solutions is my company. But I would check out the stuff that we haven't released a lot of it yet. But if you go to the Silence blog, that's where we did a lot of stuff. And then it's not available now, but if you go and just subscribe to the Electronic Frontier Foundation's YouTube page, you will start seeing the videos that we're pushing out for them. So go ahead, just subscribe now, and you'll see the videos.
Yeah, you probably want to see the stuff from EFF anyway.
Yes, they're awesome. That was the nicest thing, by the way, when I was on the floor, the number of people complimenting me. I'm not. By the way, we were volunteering a lot of the work that we were doing, and I'm like, well, thank you. I can't really take all credit for it. In fact, zero credit for it, but I'll take it regardless.
Because behind this video is a team. It's called the EFF. They're kind of a big deal.
They're kind of the ones who do everything, and I was walking around with a microphone flag that said,
right,
EFF on it.
That's awesome. Thank you, David. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Monday is a holiday here in the U.S. TWIT will be closed for the day, so expect a new TNT episode next Tuesday and throughout the rest of the week. 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, midnight UTC at twit.tv/live. Megan will be here on Tuesday as well. You can be part of the show by emailing us, tnt@twit.tv. You can leave us a short voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. You can also find us on Twitter. We are at TechNewsTodayTV. And, of course, if you want to subscribe to the show, all of the links that you need to do that are at twit.tv/TNT. That's the overall place to go for this show. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at @JaysNowell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director, Anthony. Thanks to Mario for helping out here in the studio. Thanks to Kevin for editing the show. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see you all on Tuesday. This is the part where we high five. It's okay. I didn't warn you about that.